From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Volunteers are racing to comb through the wreckage of Paradise, California today, looking for human remains before rain that's forecast for the middle of the week. That would be welcome news for firefighters, but of course it would make the recovery effort much more difficult. So far, around 80 people have been confirmed dead in the campfire, but nearly 1,000 people are still missing. Michelle Wiley just returned from Paradise. She's back at KQED in San Francisco. Michelle, we know that California counties each are now required to have these rescue teams, all of whom have converged on Paradise. Some are just, you know, retiree volunteers. What was it like to be there?
So I think we can say that this is one of the largest search and rescue operations in California history. And part of that is because the area that burned is a rural area. So there's a lot of searching that has to be done out in the woods, out in more remote locations. And it was a really fast moving fire. So it took hold really quickly and spread really quickly.
Yeah. Well, over the weekend, Butte County Sheriff Corey Honia said, "We may never know the exact death toll from this fire." But tell us more about this missing list. It was over 1,000, now just under, 1,000. Are people calling in to say they're not missing?
Yeah, so as you can imagine, when this happened, because of the rapid spread, people really scattered. You know, they got out of town as soon as they possibly could. They were running up the freeway trying to escape. And I think that what happened there, why there's been a decrease in the missing list, is because now that people are getting back connected with the county, now that they're in a safer location or at least a more secure location, they're able to confirm, I am actually okay, I'm fine, and my loved ones are fine.
What was that like to be in Paradise?
I've really never seen anything like it. You know, you can kind of conceptualize over what a fast-moving fire might look like, but these are buildings that are completely leveled to the ground. You know, it's twisted metal. There's power lines all over the ground. And one thing that was really striking to me is how quiet it was. Mm-hmm. You know, all the animals fled when the fire started spreading. So there's no bird sounds. There's sounds of people working, trying to recover the area, but just the sound of life is really gone.
Yeah. And as we said, some of these are retired volunteers. It's got to be, I don't want to be too grim, but again, we just are trying to hammer home what this is like. And we were told to don't overlook something that looks like a pot because it might be a skull. I mean, this is heartbreaking work.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to even conceive of it, really. Mm-hmm. When I was up in Paradise, when we were there, you could, even touching the ground 8 days after the fire had started, it was still hot. And I think that gives you an impression of like what this could mean. And so many people, because it spread so quickly, were unable to escape. You know, we heard dispatch tape of a woman who was pregnant, who needed a C-section, and people were trying to rush her out, and we don't know what happened.
Look, you also went to nearby Chico, to that Walmart parking lot where people are living in tents. There's a tent city that's grown up there. Tons of volunteers there just bringing things like racks of clothing. But a lot of people there came down with the same norovirus that's hit some of the shelters. Here's Christina Hickson.
I don't know how I got sick. You know, I guess this norovirus is going around, stomach flu. I've been sick all night, very sick. And shelters are condensed and not everybody's hygienically clean, so we're trying to just kind of get a place where we feel safe and secure. And
Michelle, tell us more about that. I mean, you have a large group of people there.
Yeah, and really the most tragic part is that Christina Hickson was staying in the Walmart parking lot to avoid getting norovirus. She was trying to avoid getting sick. That's why she didn't want to go to a shelter and ended up getting sick anyway.
Yeah.
And part of it is that the condition there, you know, Chico is in Northern California. It's really cold at night. It's like in the 30s, like below freezing. Yeah. So people staying out in shelters are exposed to those elements. And I mean, some of them are getting sick.
Yeah. And who else did you just share another person you might have met?
Sure. Yeah, I spoke to one family who had a kid, and as you said, like the air quality here is really damaging, especially for children and the elderly. And they're telling me they're having just the hardest time getting their little baby, 1 or 2 years old, to keep the face mask on, even though she's most at danger. You know, how do you explain to a little kid you got to keep this on? It's so important.
Look, the fire's still burning. Where and how big is it?
So the fires burned 151,000 acres. Right now, it's 66% contained. And I should explain, containment means that they've set up a line around the fire. It's still burning, but a containment line is what keeps it in. So it's 66% contained at this point, and over 11,000 residences have been destroyed.
Yeah. Look, Michelle Wiley, you're back in San Francisco, hundreds of miles away, where people are also wearing masks.
Yes. So the smoke has blown quite far right into the Bay Area. Driving back from Chico, I actually, you know, I took my mask off for a little bit in the car when the air cleared. And as soon as I got in the Bay, I had to put it right back on. The air level is hazardous for children, for the elderly. And really, most people have just avoided being outside.
Well, Michelle Wiley of KQED in San Francisco and just back from Paradise, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks.
And of course, wildfires are not the only trauma that Californians are dealing with. Hundreds of people gathered over the weekend to remember two of the victims of this month's mass shooting at the Borderline Bar and Grill in Thousand Oaks. The massacre left 12 people dead and caused Americans once again to examine the role of guns in the culture. As WABE's Lisa Hagen reports, some medical students want to make gun safety a part of their training.
It's lunchtime at Atlanta's Emory University, and about 100 medical students are busy scarfing down their meals in a lecture hall.
Thank you so much for coming today. Support Safe's mission to end.
They're here on their own time to learn about how to talk to future patients about gun safety for a total of 1 hour.
That was the most we've talked about it this year.
Alyssa Greenhouse is a second-year med student at Emory. She organized the lunch session because learning how to have a gun talk with patients is not a part of mandatory medical school curriculum.
We have had entire problem-based learning sessions on talking about tobacco cessation. We have to take a history with every patient, and it asks, you know, are you safe in the home? Do you wear your helmet? Do you wear your seatbelt? But we just don't talk about firearms.
Public health groups believe raising patient awareness around the risk of firearms can help reduce gun deaths. Across the country, presentations like the one at Emory are happening because students like Greenhouse volunteer to organize them. She wants to put on two events like this a year. She's working with a larger group called Scrubs Addressing the Firearms Epidemic, or SAFE. It wants to make firearms injury prevention something all med students learn about. Dr. Neil Gesundheit is also with SAFE. He's in charge of med school curriculum at Stanford University. And to get at why he thinks a change is needed, he uses this example.
If you look at how much attention is given to a topic like colon cancer, there is quite a bit of curricular time that is spent on the physiology, the pathology, the prevention of colon cancer via screening methods.
He says colon cancer kills about 40 to 50,000 people a year.
Well, it turns out gun violence claims about 40,000 lives in the U.S. per year. That's the asymmetry that bothers me.
So how do you get class time on gun safety to be on par with something like colon cancer?
One way is to create a curriculum that is then transmitted from one school to the next.
He says Stanford is working on that model curriculum now, which could be ready in a couple of years. But getting it to catch on across the country, that's a decade or more of work, he thinks. Doctors like Gesundheit are confident there's a lot of support within the medical community for more training on gun injury prevention. But of course, doctors are just one half of this equation.
Can I ask you to respond as if I were a doctor?
Yeah.
Asking you, like, what would you say?
I would say it's none of your business.
Jerry Henry is with the gun rights advocacy group Georgia Carey.
The doctor's business is what's my blood pressure, what's my red cell count, my white cell count. Do I have any problems? I have a bad back. Do I want to get it fixed? No, I'll live with it. And the rest of it should be left to me.
Henry says none of his doctors have ever asked about his plentiful access to firearms, and there isn't a ton of research on how patients actually react to those questions. One small study from more than a decade ago found that about 9% of patients are like Henry, the none-of-your-business type. But about 70% in that survey had no problem being asked about guns back then. A researcher in Atlanta is hoping to follow up on that question now.
I anticipate we'll get a similar response, to be honest.
Dr. Lauren Hudak is an emergency medicine professor at Emory University. She also treats patients at Atlanta's Grady Hospital, where an average of 4 people a day come in with gunshot injuries. Hudak and her colleagues are doing patient surveys to learn how people feel about doctors or nurses asking about guns. And she says a crucial part of the project will be to understand more about the none-of-your-business crowd.
Where patients feel like, that's my own choice, I can do what I want, and I don't need the doctor up in my business about that. It happens a lot in lots of clinical scenarios, like helmet safety, seatbelts, cigarettes. There's a lot of reasons people don't want to tell us things.
Hudak says pushing patients to answer questions against their will is not the goal, nor is it to come up with an approach doctors everywhere can use.
Georgia's not the same as California, not the same as Boston. So I think it's important to do it in the healthcare setting that you're actually going to be doing the intervention work.
Dr. Hudak is looking to have some early results next month. For Here and Now, I'm Lisa Hagen in Atlanta.
And Lisa's story comes to us from Guns and America, a public media reporting project on the role of guns in American life. Election results are still trickling in nearly 2 weeks later, and it looks like Democrats will control all of the House seats representing Orange County, California, for the first time since the 1940s. Orange County has long been a Republican stronghold. It's where Ronald Reagan launched his political career, and it's also the home of another famous Republican, the only U.S. president ever to have resigned from office. That would be Richard Nixon. Here he was on August 9th, 1974, almost halfway through his second term in office, and he was facing almost certain impeachment and removal from office because of the Watergate scandal.
To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
That's one of the first things many Americans know or remember about Richard Nixon. But when I visited the Nixon Library and Museum in Yorba Linda, California, resident historian Greg Cumming walked me through part of an exhibit showing the assassinations and unrest that preceded Nixon's election. He said Nixon was taking office during one of the most tumultuous times in American history.
You look at the 60s in turmoil. You have JFK who's assassinated. You have race riots, one close by here in Los Angeles, the Watts riots.
Right.
You have a Vietnam War that is really becoming controversial. Not to mention, too, was the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy. So the most controversial time in American history since the Civil War. Why would you want to be president in 1968 is the question. So we get to his inaugural.
The simple things are the ones most needed today if we are to surmount what divides us and cement what unites us. To lower our voices would be a simple thing.
So he's saying he's trying to get America to start listening to each other. Now, does he accomplish that? That's up to the individuals to decide whether he accomplishes that goal or exacerbates it.
If you continue through the museum, you will find the section on Watergate. But Greg Cumming says there was much more to Nixon's legacy than that.
If you are in our research room, there's very little research on Watergate. I think it's a very difficult topic to understand. The opening to China, I think, is a bigger part of his long-term legacy than Watergate will be. Watergate will always be connected with Nixon, but you really have to look at some of the other accomplishments he's had.
Nixon's visit to China even inspired an opera.
I am most proud to welcome you.
What did he do that was so important?
Well, this is a country that since 1949 that we've had absolutely zero relationship with. We were actually fighting with them during the Korean War, if you remember. No embassies, nothing going on. And here is this supposed anti-communist Nixon, and out of nowhere, seemingly, he announces in 1971 that he'll be visiting Beijing in February of 72. And this was like a lightning bolt out of the blue. And it really changed major power structure quite a bit.
We have at times in the past been enemies. We have great differences today.
What brings us together is that we have common interests which transcend those differences.
Although China and the Soviet Union still supplied weaponry to Vietnam, it really made North Vietnamese a little nervous and gave them a reason also to pursue a negotiated end of the Vietnam War, or I should say the United States version of the Vietnam War.
What's his legacy when it comes to the Vietnam War in general?
That one, I think, is still being written. There are some that will say there are 20,000 casualties during the Nixon administration. What were they there for? But the fact that he was able to find peace and find a way to extricate the United States with a minimum amount of problems, I think is also important and should be part of the equation.
The question at issue is not whether Johnson's war becomes Nixon's war. The great question is, how can we win America's peace?
Current academics probably come down more on the negative side at this moment.
What about Russia, the Soviet Union at the time, and the Cold War?
And detente. If you look at today's world, there's a great deal of confrontation with the other superpowers. Nixon was able to truly lessen that and make it a safer world with his treaty with the Soviet Union regarding strategic arms limitation. And as Reagan got through the first few years, I think 84, 85, 86, served as a model for how he could work with Gorbachev.
What about his domestic legacy? What are the key elements of his domestic legacy?
This is the one that really doesn't get much notoriety at all, and positively, I'd say. Desegregation of Southern schools. You have his push for the Family Assistance Plan, which was a new type of welfare, which would have guaranteed every American at least a minimal level of income. So there was a number of things that he was involved in, the Philadelphia plan, trying to increase the number of government contracts going to minority-owned business. So he was very active, and it's not seen a lot, clean air, clean water, things of that nature.
The Environmental Protection Agency. Yeah.
The environmental agenda now before the Congress includes laws to deal with water pollution, pesticide hazards, ocean dumping, excessive noise, careless land development, and many other environmental problems.
You'd almost think he was a Democrat in today's world.
Well, you have to remember the politics of two major parties. The interesting thing, as I explain this to my students quite a bit, is during the 60s and 70s, each party had a liberal and a moderate and a conservative wing. So it wasn't like today where one party is absolutely conservative and the other is absolutely progressive. It didn't function like that. In my mind, he was a moderate Republican willing to look at each issue on its own basis and merit.
We're sitting here in Yorba Linda, California, in Orange County. Was there something about this place that shaped him and his politics?
Yeah, it's small town America, and those are the type of values he had. It also, I think, shaped him with a little chip on his shoulder. He came from small town California, rural California, Southern California, didn't go to the East Coast prep schools, did not go to an Ivy League school. He was a very smart, very intellectual person, but he was always trying to demonstrate that as well.
So that brings us to Watergate, which a lot of people, that's the first word that would come to their mind if they think of Richard Nixon. What was it that gave him that level of insecurity about winning his reelection that led him to do what he did?
I honestly could not. I don't know. In my opinion, I thought he, against George McGovern, it was a slam dunk unless you do something really, really bad. Watergate was not necessary. Now, he's never been tried for the events that happened at Watergate itself, at the Watergate. It was what happened afterwards is what got him in trouble with Congress. And it's up to interpretation, but it was the attempted cover-up.
There have been a lot of stories recently about Watergate, because many people are looking at President Trump, who's under investigation right now, and saying he better be careful not to repeat the mistakes of Richard Nixon. What do you think about the comparisons?
Well, that, for me, that's, as the historian in me says, you know, they're two different people, apples and oranges, to be honest with you, in completely different times.
Well, what are the lessons from Richard Nixon that would apply today?
I think the lessons are just always keep in mind how important it is to be transparent in government. I think that's one of the key components. You look back to like Ronald Reagan during the Iran-Contra, and he did they had the investigation, and he got up and mea culpa. The American electorate is very forgiving if a mistake has been made, but the American electorate is not very forgiving if they feel that they've been hoodwinked. I think we can look back in American history and say a president who is up front is usually the best policy instead of trying to cover up. You looking back to Lyndon Johnson and what happened in the Vietnam War and the credibility gap that starts there, that's where problems are created.
What is one thing that you think that Americans don't know about Richard Nixon that you know that we ought to know?
Well, most people, I would say, probably don't know that he was raised in a Quaker household, and yet he went against his faith to go fight in World War II because he thought it was so important. He tries in his own way to lessen war, but yet he gets accused of being, to a certain extent, more aggressive with the military. And the second thing, there's one other thing that most people don't know, is that he was extremely helpful to Native Americans and signed legislation that improved their lives and continues to be very popular on Indian reservations today.
Our Indian people, who are a small part of America in numbers, have made an enormous contribution because they have given great character to so many parts of our country.
Signed back land to the Native Americans. So most people would never associate Richard Nixon with Native Americans.
That's Greg Cumming, resident historian at the Nixon Museum in Yorba Linda, California. By the way, Saturday marked 45 years since Nixon uttered these famous words.
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
And November is National Long-Term Care Awareness Month, but we know many of you are painfully aware that taking care of an older relative can be both a privilege and extremely trying. According to a new study out from the AP and the National Opinion Research Center, caring for a loved one is the equivalent of a full-time job for a quarter of informal caregivers, two-thirds of whom are women, many of whom are cutting back on paid jobs or dipping into their own retirement funds to do it. So question, should there be a new compensation model for them? Jill Schlesinger, a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money and the podcast Better Off, is here. Jill, some might be surprised to learn that Medicare, for those over 65, doesn't cover many of these costs. And in order for seniors to be on Medicaid, health care for the poor, that often covers more long-term care, you have to spend down a loved one's assets so they qualify.
Yeah, and this is state specific. So you really have to have your research hat on and look at the guidelines for your specific state. But generally speaking, for an individual, say it's maybe having savings of a couple of $1,000s and maintaining a home. Maybe the home is worth anywhere between $500,000 and $800,000 or $850,000, again, depending on your state. But the problem is that there are a lot of people out there who are gifting willy-nilly money out of their names to try to qualify for Medicaid, not realizing that there is a 5-year look back period that the states are able to do. And it's a little bit dangerous to do this because sometimes when you are gifting money, you're also gifting some pretty significant tax consequences. So you should be doing this with a very specific reason in mind, and you should be doing it with a professional.
Well, meanwhile, a lot of people are trying to figure out ways to compensate, especially moms who are maybe, you know, missing work or spending money out of their own pockets to take care of these elderly loved ones. Some people talk about a universal basic income. But meanwhile, how can they do this more through their workplace?
It's really interesting because backup elder care is becoming a benefit that some organizations are considering for their employees. And it comes in two primary forms. dependent care assistance plans, and that deducts a certain portion of your paycheck before taxes to pay for elder care costs, much in the way that you would do that for your child care expenses. And right now, about 40% of employers are offering that benefit. Hmm. And then a smaller fraction are also offering something that I think is going to become more popular called respite care. This is a benefit that offers short-term care to family members when this employee needs to take a rest or take time off or go into work. So you should be checking with that in addition to flexible work options, care subsidies. Some are buying group plans to help you with senior caregiving expenses, and support groups, because boy, what we now know is that there is very little care for the caregivers themselves, and they need to recharge their batteries.
Yeah. Yes, they do. And just one thing I want to note from my own personal experience, it's great that this is happening through different workplaces, but the people who get the least help with this are the people who are the home health aides, the people who maybe have blue-collar jobs, mm. who don't have access to those kinds of benefits. So it's worth keeping that in mind as well. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Jill, thank you.
Thank you.
British Prime Minister Theresa May tried today to sell business leaders in the UK on her plan to leave the European Union. She spoke at the Confederation of British Industries annual conference. Here she is addressing the opposition that her deal is facing from members of her own Conservative Party.
Don't just listen to the politicians. Listen to what business is saying. And business is saying we want a good deal with the EU and we want a good trading relationship with the European Union.
May announced a Brexit deal with the EU last week, but she faces tremendous pressure at home to get members of parliament on board. Today she said migration to the UK would become skills-based and that Europeans would no longer be favored over people from other countries. You can find all of our reporting on Brexit from my trip to London at hereandnow.org. Now, let's go to another edition of the DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Jose Galvan is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He is with us. Hi, Jose.
Hey, Jeremy. How's it going?
It's going well. And let's get right to the music that you brought us. This is Arthur. It's by the Red Parrots. Kind of a lo-fi sound there.
Yeah, definitely garagey. These guys are out of El Monte, California, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. Not very known for their rock bands, but these guys have been making the rounds at house parties and just sort of garnered a huge following of kids. And as you know, in music, what the kids like is what the industry sort of pays attention to. So they're getting a lot of buzz.
They do have kind of a surfer sound.
Yeah, they do. And that's what I like about it. It's also reminiscent of the Stroke sound, just a little mm-hmm. more lo-fi.
All right, the next one you brought us is Coral. This is by Rubio. You hear the singing in Spanish there. This is a Chilean performer.
Correct. Yes. Rubio comes out of Santiago, and she used to front a band called Miss Garrison. It was a trio, and they were more rock, but she sort of followed the path that Chile's music scene has been going in since 2009, which is sort of that electro-pop vibe. Hmm. It's a little dubby. There's bands like Javier Amena, Astro, Teleradio Donoso, all these heavy synths and just sort of drum beats.
How did you get turned on to Rubio?
I believe somebody sent me an MP3, and I was just like, oh, the like killer voice. And then I did some research, and it turned out she had been part of Miss Garrison, the band I mentioned, and saw her live here in LA and was just floored. She does all the loops, all the samples. She sings, she like drums on the side, and they have a live violinist, which you can't really hear in the recordings, but apparently it's there.
Hmm. Next up, you have brought us Remind Me. This is from Emily King. So I guess this would be described as like a bubblegum style, right?
Yeah, and you could qualify it into R&B a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of what she's known for. She was Grammy nominated for her debut, East Side Story, back in 2007. Then she made the rounds opening up for Alicia Keys, Nas, a bunch of other sort of hip-hop R&B artists. ATO signed her. She'd been absent for about 4 years, and this is the first single off her forthcoming album, due out February 2019, and it's kind of begging for a remix, I think.
Really? What do you mean by that?
Because it has that very slow build in the beginning. It's got about, you know, like almost 32 bars of no real backbeat, just her voice, little ambient sound, and then it just sort of kicks in. Like a new beginning. Someone's going to pick that up and make a really rad remix.
Why don't you do it?
Oh, I should. You're a genius, Jeremy.
Right. There you go. You can credit me on the album. I'll take the royalties. Let's move on to the next one you brought us. This is Good. It's by Twin XL. Getting dancier as we go here, Jose. Tell us about this one.
Oh, yes. These guys are out of Los Angeles. And sometimes when we talk about KCRW DJs being eclectic, I think a lot of people assume that we're not going to like pop music or sort of play pop music. But this is a real poppy song. It's got that, you know, the synths and the chill vocals, an earworm of a melody. And it's got a little bit of that like millennial whistle, sort of bitonal melody that happens right now in music.
Okay, we have time for one more, and this is I'm Scum. It's by Idols. Hey, hey. I'm Council House of Violet. I'm laughing at the tyrants. I'm sleeping on the sirens. Whilst wondering where the time went. So this album is called Joy as an Act of Resistance. You can hear some of that there. Tell us about Idols.
Idols are right now currently one of my favorite bands. I got to catch them at one of those multi-day festivals about a week ago, and they were just so intense on stage, but their lyrics are sort of tongue-in-cheek. They're poking fun at themselves. They're poking fun at society. It's sort of like the UK stuff. They got a couple songs about immigration. It's a real mishmash of stuff, but it falls in line with that punk rock vibe that's sort of coming out of the UK. These guys are from Bristol, and I love the lead singer's voice. It sort of sounds like he gargles with nails. It's intense.
Jose, you probably see and hear a lot of music every year. What's the best thing you've seen this year so far?
Oh, I'd have to go with Idols.
Really?
By far, yeah. Yeah, it's just, I don't know, it's hard to beat a guitarist who's up in Speedos on stage. And a lead singer who's just kind of like, you can tell he doesn't want to be up there, sort of, but he's really good at it, and I don't know if it's an act, but I'm in.
That's Jose Galvan, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. Jose, thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
And you can find all our DJ session picks on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Mountains of trash end up in landfills around the world every year. And as that waste decomposes, it releases methane, a potent greenhouse gas. And burning trash also pumps a lot of carbon emissions into the air. Well, there is one place in Japan that's creating a blueprint for disposing of trash in a different way. Sonia Narang takes us to a rural Japanese community known as a zero-waste town.
It's not yet 8 a.m., and the recycling center in Kamikatsu is already bustling with activity. A steady stream of residents arrive and unload trunks full of bottles, cans, and paper items. They separate recyclables into dozens of clearly labeled bins lined up in neat rows. Kamikatsu is a small town of about 2,000 people in the forested mountains of Japan. The waste collection center here runs a tight ship, and everything is carefully sorted and arranged with the help of staff. There are a whopping 45 different categories of recyclables, and the town recycles 80% of its trash. Akira Sakano heads up the town's Zero Waste Academy. That's a nonprofit organization that manages the recycling program. Every resident gets a thick booklet of recycling guidelines to learn as they go. They have 9 subcategories just for paper, even paper with aluminum on it. Sakano walks me to a large bin.
We have, let's say, newspapers, cardboard, scrap papers, shredded papers, paper containers, paper container with aluminum packaging on the back, paper cups, hard paper tubes, and then other papers.
She pokes a magnet around in the bin to see if it catches any steel cans mixed in with the aluminum. Before Kamikatsu adopted its zero-waste policy in 2003, the town used to burn all its trash in incinerators. Officials realized how that impacts the environment and people's health. Recycling also has an economic benefit.
It costs 6 times less for recycling or how we manage the waste right now compared to incinerating everything.
Trash pickup is not a thing here. Almost everyone has to bring their waste in themselves. For the older residents who can't drive themselves to the recycling center, the town does send a pickup truck. I hitch a ride with the driver, Kazuyuki Kiyohara. Kiyohara is really concerned about using the Earth's resources wisely, and he's got more than a dozen separate bins at his own home.
I have metal bottle caps, plastic bottle caps, milk containers, plastic packaging from laundry detergent, plastic trays, plastic wrappings and containers.
He's so intense, he even inspects his family's trash.
I give my family members instructions on how to wash recyclables properly at home. After they wash an item, I check it and I go, it's still dirty, and I ask them to wash it once again.
Many locals say having to wash and dry all their food packaging is the most annoying thing. Back at the recycling center, I catch Daichi Hyakuno as he unloads bags of juice cans, plastics, and dirty diapers. He moved here from Osaka a few years ago.
It was easier in Osaka, since all I had to do was separate trash into burnables and non-burnables. Since it's so detailed here, there was a lot I didn't understand. It was tough.
As a single father of two small kids, he says he's too busy to sort his trash and wash and dry juice cartons.
I wonder why we have to do this much. But as a Kamikatsu resident, I have no choice but to separate my recyclables. And I will continue to do so.
15 years ago, when I lived in Japan, I remember I had to write my name in big black letters on clear trash bags. It made me feel so conscious about what I threw away. If I left even one bottle in there, the town wouldn't pick up the trash, and everyone would see my bag left out on the curb. Akira Sakano from the Zero Waste Academy says it takes time to get people to buy in. But once they learn, there's no going back.
Japan has, of course, good or bad, this kind of social pressure. If everyone's doing it, and then maybe you need to do it, people got used to it. So it's how they change the customs. And once the custom is changed, then it becomes habit.
Kamikatsu is gaining international attention. On the day I visit, folks from a Japanese branch of the clothing company Patagonia are here at the Zero Waste Academy to learn.
Yes, exactly.
And well beyond the small town, people are recognizing that reducing how much you throw out could be a big step in the global battle against climate change. For Here and Now, I'm Sonia Narang.
And Sonia's story comes to us from WHYY's The Pulse. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.